All digital, I guess.
It is digital, yeah. This is Natasha Tastuk interviewing Brigadier General Jim Hansen on 13th November 2007. We're here at the UVic Library. So let's start off with some basic information. When and where were you born?
Ottawa, the Ottawa Civic Hospital, 15th of February, 1938.
Wonderful. Were either of your parents employed by the military?
No, but my father had been what they call Canadian Officer Training Corps mm-hmm. in the 1920s. This was a reserve thing that you did when you were going through university. So you came out of it with a commission, which mm-hmm. he did, with a commission in the engineers. But he became a surveyor, and when the war broke out, he wasn't allowed to take up his commission because he was doing hydrographic survey work as a civilian, of course, on the east coast, and was considered more essential.
Okay.
He actually surveyed the approaches to what's now Goose Bay, Labrador,
wow.
so that he could take ships in there and build
wow.
the aerodrome.
That's really interesting. When did you join the military and into which branch of the service?
I went in the Army and the militia in 1961 in Kingston, the Princess of Wales own regiment, and then a year later, discovering that this was sort of fun, I switched to the regular Army, also in Kingston, and I went into the Royal Canadian Electrical and Mechanical mm-hmm. Engineers because they were the only people that would have me at the time.
What made you want to join?
I joined the militia, I guess, because it was the infantry. There were a lot of World War II veterans kicking around. Every young man in those days sort of wondered if he could have hacked the pace in the war, and the militia was a way to do it, at least test yourself, so that was a factor. Also, I was young and newly married and working at a fairly interesting civilian job, but the civilian job didn't engage me at night, and I knew the militia would, so mm-hmm. there was a challenge there. And, of course, they paid me.
Yeah.
I got my first paycheck or my first bundle of money at Christmas time and promptly was told to give all of it but $10 to the officer's mess. Oh,
really?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
That was the way it worked.
Just told, and that's what you do, yeah.
yeah. Well, one guy paid you, and the next guy took it.
Yeah. When were you stationed with the 4th Canadian Mechanized Brigade Group?
I got posted over the first time in August of 1965, and I was there until August of 1969.
Okay, and was that in Zost?
That was in Zost,
okay.
in North Germany, and I was stationed in what they called Fort Chambly, which was mm-hmm. one of the small garrisons around the town of Zost. I was posted back in 1974 to Lahr in South Germany, and I was there until 1976.
Okay. And you were with the Princess of Wales the whole time?
Oh, no. When I joined the regular Army, I left the Princess of Wales own regiment, which was in the militia, and it was infantry, and I went into the regular Army.
Right, okay. What was your rank when you joined?
I actually went in as a private, but I was quickly commissioned as a provisional second lieutenant in the militia. When I went into the regular Army, because I had a commission in the militia, I went from lieutenant, which I was in the regular militia, back to second lieutenant in the regular Army, so... I've been a second lieutenant twice.
Yeah. And then when you retired?
I was a brigadier general.
Yeah. Okay. And when did you retire?
I retired officially, I guess, in August of 1991. I was still on the books
wow.
until the following spring because I was on what they call rehab leave.
Quite recently,
but,
hey?
Yep. Yeah, well, 16 years ago
career.
Now.
That's a long career. Very long.
Yeah, 29 years in the regular Army,
wow.
a year in the militia. And
wow.
That's when I got out and went back to school.
To school, right, yep. Now let's move on and talk about weapon systems and procurement. What kind of weapons were you provided with in 4th MBG? And you can speak with reference to Zost or Lahr. Both.
Sure, both. Mm-hmm. Okay, start with the real simple stuff. In 1952-53, the government bought a whole fleet of vehicles and over that the next 2 or 3 years, weapon systems for the Army. And when I got to Germany in 1965, all the vehicles that we had, military vehicles, what they're called standard military pattern vehicles, had been purchased in 1952 or 1953. So they were getting pretty old. They were still there when I left in 1976.
Wow.
They were just talking about replacing the one-quarter ton truck in 76. I think it was replaced about a year later. This was the famous Jeep. And the three-quarter ton truck was replaced about a year after that in 1978. We had the FN rifles, which were manufactured in Canada to a Belgian design in the early 1950s, and we used them up until about the time I retired. Mm. Still had them. The machine guns were M1919 Brownings. We had them originally 30 caliber. They were rechambered for 7.62 Browning M2 50 caliber machine guns, which I think they still use. The standard artillery pieces were a towed 105mm howitzer and a towed 155mm howitzer. We got self-propelled howitzers in 1968 in Germany,
okay.
the M109. still using, I'm sure. The M113A1 family of armored personnel carriers first were introduced in Germany in 64, mm-hmm. but were not in general use until 65 because everybody had to be retrained. So the whole brigade was in APCs in 1965 when I arrived.
Okay.
And we're still using them when I left. Mm-hmm. The Centurion tank was a 1952 vehicle. I think when we bought them, it had a 20-pounder gun on it. It was eventually upgraded to 105-millimeter. And they were still using them when I left in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
We got the Lone Leopards in 1976. And they were replaced by the Canadian Leopards in 1978. Old tanks. And they're now getting even older. But the Centurion was almost unmaintainable by the time we got rid of it. Nobody else had them.
Yeah.
We had the Dutch rebuilding them. We rebuilt them in Canada. The Canadian ones were rebuilt in Montreal. And the Leopards were a good tank at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Obsolescent now, but at the time were a good tank.
We've got Leopard 2 now, right?
We're buying them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Interestingly enough, the first Leopard CO was a guy named Clive Milner, who's now a retired Major General in Kingston. He was replaced by Gordon O'Connor, who had the first Canadian Leopards, and O'Connor was just the Minister of Defense.
Really?
Yeah, and an Armored Corps guy. He retired as a Brigadier General, eventually became a politician, a conservative, and became Minister of Defense, I guess, in the Harper government, and was moved about 6 months ago.
Yeah. That was very comprehensive. Thank you. Now, what training was provided for the use of these weapons?
Everybody that went to Germany basically was trained to a fairly high standard before they ever left Canada. That was the idea. You didn't get to Germany unless you had been trained in either your trade or your craft. And they eventually started bringing in younger soldiers, but they were trained in all the basic weapon systems before they ever got to Germany. So that was, Germany was fed by the training system and by regular force units back in Canada to ensure that it was always up to a standard that we would need to have if we ever had to go to war, which we had suspected at some point we might.
Yeah, well, certainly. And then once in Germany, there were regular exercises carried out.
Yeah, up north, the whole brigade would go out in the spring to a place called Sennelager, which was a range camp, basically, and you did small unit tactics and fired all your basic weapon systems. You were there for about 3 or 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
In the autumn, we'd go to a place called Soltau, which was up near Lüneburg, and we'd do, pardon me, larger field-scale exercises.
Mm-hmm.
The combat arms would go to range camps more extensively. The Armored Corps and the artillery went up to Traun and Bergen-Hona. And we would provide maintenance people for them at the time. But and then usually in the autumn, the brigade would go out on a British divisional exercise, a big exercise. The 4 years I was there, we did three of them.
Did you? Okay.
And they were pretty wild. I mean, the entire division would be out on the road moving all over Germany. It was a really very good practice. And the British thought we were strange because we would always go into the woods to hide. They would go into villages. And after a while, we said, hey, but this makes sense, because if the bad guys have air superiority, it would be harder for them to find you in a village, because you could get your stuff in barns, than it would in, you know, they just fly over a patch of woods and see a bunch of lights at night, and they knew that's where you were. So we eventually started doing more and more village deployments.
Yeah, and how did the people respond to that?
Oh, they got paid. They had, of course, up north the British treated the Germans as a conquered people, and what you had to do was, months before you went out on exercise, you had to go up through the British chain of command and say, we want to do an exercise in this area, and this would be a large area. And then they had the land liaison officers would go out, German speakers, who would go to the villages, talk to the local mayors, and arrange it all.
Okay.
And there would be also areas where they didn't want you to go, like water catchment areas, you know, and places like that. So they'd be marked on your maps that you didn't go
in. Stay out of. Okay, so it was all preordained.
All preorganized.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Now I know Canada had access to the Honest John rocket launchers. Were nuclear weapons available to force CMBG? And if so, who's in control of them? What sort of protocol was there for their usage?
Yeah, they had nuclear ammunition supply points. And when we were up north, it was not too far from where the Honest John battery was stationed, and there was an American artillery detachment. And it was a two-keyed operation. My understanding is a two-keyed operation that you couldn't collect the nuclear weapons without the Americans agreeing to it. They would go up their chain of command for their release, and we would go up ours through NATO for our release. And interestingly enough, there was up north, I think it was called the 69th U.S. Army Artillery Detachment. It would be a young captain, and he had a key to these nuclear weapons for the Honest John.
Wow.
And they were basically living in the same garrison as the Honest John Battery, mm-hmm. the Canadian Honest John mm-hmm. Battery. One of the guys that commanded it is now dead, but his son is actually stationed here in town.
Really?
Yeah, but he wouldn't. He might know. But his name is John Crossman. He's a colonel and he works in Maritime Pacific Headquarters. But his dad was also John Crossman and he commanded the SSM Battery at one time.
Okay, thank you. During your tour in Germany, did you notice any sort of fluctuations in the emphasis that the government placed upon conventional versus nuclear warfare? So, I mean, it can be based on politics or funding or any sort of fluctuation that you on the ground noticed in terms of, okay, we're going to emphasize more conventional versus the nuclear aspect?
From our viewpoint, it was all the same. Mm-hmm. You trained to the worst-case scenario, which was tactical nuclear weapons, and the tactics were appropriate for a battle that didn't include nuclear weapons but could escalate to nuclear weapons. There was a dramatic change in the government's policy about 1969. Mr. Trudeau decided that we didn't really need to be in Germany, and he sent a parliamentary delegation over in the spring of 1969 when the brigade was still up north, and we were told probably tales of rumors that Trudeau had told them to come back and report that the brigade and the air division should come home. And they visited 4 brigade in the field. The Major General, Brigadier General Jim Gardner, then was the commander, and he briefed them on what we were doing, and they went and talked to the British. And they came away with the conclusion that not only were we doing an excellent job for Canada, but we should be reinforced and not brought home. And they took that message back to Mr. Trudeau, and Mr. Trudeau decided to cut us in two and move us down south. But Mr. General Gardner was a very eloquent man.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he was a World War II veteran, escaped mm-hmm. 3 or 4 times from the Italians and the Germans in Italy, and mm-hmm. and knew what he was talking about. And our brigade was probably as good as some of the British divisions, you know, half the size, but as good as.
Yeah.
And that's the message they got.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did the weapons available to 4CMBG compare to those of other NATO members you may have observed?
Up north, our artillery pieces, and by and large, and tanks were the same as the British. Mm-hmm. And so they were as good as, and in some cases as vulnerable mm-hmm. as the British. The British had their own armored personnel carriers, the FV-430 family, which were made of steel and gasoline engines, whereas we had the M113A1, which was aluminum and diesel, about the same time. So we had 2 different chains of spare parts, 1 back through the British, actually 3, 1 back to Canada and 1 back to mm-hmm. the United States. It was a problem with the M113A1 because, of course, the Vietnam War was on, and priority for spare parts went to the people in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And second priority went to the Americans in Germany and then us. Of course, the Canadian military vehicles built in 1952, spare parts were always a problem. We used to send the broken stuff back to Canada and it would be repaired, usually by city contract, and then come back.
So that was quite a journey.
Yeah, and the British stuff we got on the British supply system. There was a Canadian detachment of the advanced British ordnance, the British supply depot, just outside Antwerp. Ron Mars will know about it,
mm-hmm.
but we always had a Canadian officer there. In fact, the guy, a little friend of mine, Jerry Glenn, was there for you. He just died, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Cancer got him. And so he would be the guy that shepherded all the Canadian stuff through. So we had Canadian supply items and British supply items mm-hmm. and American supply items all coming up through the system.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little more complicated down south because we were sort of attached to the Americans, but if we went to war, nobody was really sure if we were going to be part of 7th U.S. Corps or 2nd German Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And the Germans, of course, had Leopards. The Americans had M60s and eventually went to Abrams. M109s were not a problem. Everybody had them. M113A1s were not a big problem. Everybody had
mm-hmm.
them. But there were questions about some of the special stuff, you know, the Canadian-only stuff. And so would we eventually draw American or German stuff if we were there long enough? And there were big questions about what happened to, if, you know, Captain Schnooks or Lieutenant Jones or Private Laframboise, French-Canadian, got wounded, where would he go?
Yeah.
The Canadians would hand him over either to the Americans or the Germans. You could wind up in a hospital back mm-hmm. in Denver, Colorado, mm-hmm. you know, and how could we keep track of these guys?
Yeah.
That was down south. Up north, it was much easier.
Well, it was, yeah.
Yeah, because we were
part of
the British
system,
and they eventually wind up,
mm-hmm.
almost like World War II, and they
mm-hmm.
wind up back in the UK.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, I know that Ottawa signed a contract in 76 to purchase new Leopard tanks, because the Centurions at this point were far outdated. And you talked a little bit about this already, but let's clarify. How did the Leopard compare to the Centurion?
Much more agile tank. Yeah. Smaller, lighter. I think the Centurion fully loaded was somewhere in the neighborhood of 56 tons. The Leopard was somewhere under 46 tons.
Wow, significant.
The Leopard used diesel, and everything eventually was going diesel in NATO. And the Centurion, if memory serves me rightly, you got 3 gallons of gas to go a mile in the Centurion tank. With the Leopard, you could go 3 miles on a gallon of diesel.
Wow.
So your petrol oil lubricant ratio was 9 to 1. That was 9 times cheaper to run the Leopards in terms of POL. To do an engine change on the Centurion, you were looking at something like 36 man hours. It was usually a 2-man crew that wanted to do it. So they were probably out there for 1.5 to 2.5 days, and they needed a recovery vehicle with a big crane to lift the engine out. With the Leopard, I've seen the whole power pack changed in 30 minutes flat.
Wow.
Slid out on rails, a new one dropped in and slid in.
So you can do it right on the field?
Right in the field,
yeah.
You did the other ones in the field too. It was just a lot longer because
really?
The engine was underneath an auxiliary generator and saddle tanks and radiator.
Got to take the whole thing.
Everything had to come up to get the engine out.
Yeah, okay.
And it was a very complicated engine too. The Centurion engine was a Rolls-Royce Meteor. It was an aircraft engine, basically a V12 with 24 spark plugs.
24 spark plugs?
24, two per cylinder, because it was designed for an aircraft, you see.
Right.
So you didn't want a cylinder to fail, right. So you had redundant systems. And it sort of slid in and slid out instead of just coming straight out. It was just a real bugger's muddle to change the engine in a Centurion. Mm-hmm. My guys got pretty good. I had the platoon that did that for a year.
Yeah.
They got pretty good at it.
But,
when we first got the M113, they said, holy mackerel, was it ever easy to do the M113? And of course, when I was in Germany and saw the Germans showed us the Leopard change, we just couldn't believe it, because we were still driving Centurions then. Better fire control system, too, in the Leopard, I think, because they bought a computerized, digitalized fire control system when we bought the new Leopards, the Sabka, made by the Belgians, and very good. Centurion was state-of-the-art in its day. In fact, it was better than what the Americans had. But Leopard was better.
And in terms of the gunnery systems?
Yeah, there's a 105 gun on both.
Right, okay.
The Centurion had been upgraded from 20-pounder back in the early 60s, I think.
Okay. Now, I know that by 54, the Centurions were approaching the third quarter of their engine life expectancy back in 54, and we didn't get them replaced with a contract until 76. So did their replacement in 76 come far too late?
Well, we were still maintaining the Centurions. Fortunately, when I got to Germany in 74, the Dutch still had some Centurions, and we could get our Centurions rebuilt by the Dutch at some cost, of course. Up north, the British were still driving Centurions when I was there, so the British Base Workshop in Germany did their Centurions and our Centurions, and we had a little Canadian detachment in their workshop. We did the same with the Dutch. We had a Canadian civilian, ex-military guy, who looked after our tanks going through the tank workplatz, it was called, in Holland. But the Dutch were eventually going to go to Leopard, and so we were going to be really driving a Norfolk tank. So it was just in time.
Just in time, yeah.
Militarily, of course, if it hadn't been for Trudeau getting pressured by the German chancellor, then we may not have changed and we might have got out of the tank business.
Yeah. Do you know anything about how the Centurion compared to what other NATO members were using in West Germany? So, I mean, you said the Dutch were using Centurions.
Yeah,
well.
The Dutch and the British were using Centurions. They were changing to a new British tank. The Dutch, of course, went to Leopard. The Belgians went to Leopard. They had American M48s, I think, up north. The Americans had the M60 down south. Not a bad tank, but even bigger than the Centurion.
Mm-hmm.
Probably easier to maintain. The American tanks tended to be.
Yeah.
I think our fire control system, even in the Centurion, was as good as the American M60. I'm not sure. And I'm not sure who in town would know. Gene Lake,
would he?
Yep. H.P.E. Lake,
Gene Lake. I've actually got a book from him, The War with the Battles.
Yep. Sean Maloney's book.
Yeah. I haven't finished reading it yet, but it's a good one.
Yeah, Gene was a Centurion driver up
north. Was he?
Yeah. He retired as a colonel, but he was in Centurions up north, and he was with, I think he was with the 4 Brigade when the Leopards came in. I'm not sure. Certainly he did time with the recce squadron down south.
Yeah, he did, okay. Were there any other improvements in equipment during your service with 4CMBG?
I guess the introduction of the M113A1 in 1965 gave us a better mobility on the battlefield. The introduction of the M109 was much better for the artillery in terms of mobility.
Yeah.
It was much more difficult to maintain than a truck with a towed gun, but
the M109, that was a self-propelled?
Self-propelled howitzer, yeah. I think we're still driving them. And, of course, it made us all 155-millimeter guns.
Mm.
With the towed guns, we were mostly 105s with one battery of 155s. When we went to M109s, they were all 155 guns.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And good fire control systems, mm-hmm. good accuracy.
Okay.
Dave Walters, of course, was an M109 CO.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on and discuss weapons maintenance and utility a little bit. This might be an area that's not... I'm not sure how much, you know, it is your specificity, but just let me know. We'll play it by ear. What was the serviceability of Canada's main equipment and weapon systems? In other words, on any given day, say how many tanks were ready to go out in battle if the Soviets started to run, and that's going to be different for the Centurions and the Leopards.
Well, we aimed for 90%.
You aimed for 90%?
90%,
wow.
What they call a VOR rig, vehicles off the road. Yeah. We aimed to have no higher than 10% VOR, so 90% would be on the road. And because we were sort of, at least in the Canadian military, top priority for parts and mechanics, it was, you know, if we were held up for anything, it would be for a part that was
trying
to find somewhere in the system.
But we
had limitations on how far we could drive our vehicles every year as well. For example, I think for the M113A1 family, we're supposed to put no more than 1,500 miles a year on, if that. And ditto the tanks. So if we went on a big exercise, that the vehicles, tanks, and the M113s would be railed up there on rail cars to not use up the track mileage. Because the more you use them, of course, the more often they break down.
Yeah.
And you could see in the autumn, we'd get new people into the armored regiments. In the summertime, they'd be posted in, and if they hadn't spent a lot of time driving tanks, you'd start getting things like gearboxes and final drives broken for the first 2 or 3 weeks of a big exercise. And by the end of the exercise, we'd replace them all. And then the guys were good, and they could run for the next year without breaking too many final drives and gearboxes.
Just that initial sort of
learning
process.
Curve.
Yeah. Can you discuss the aging process of any of Canada's main weapons or systems?
Sure. Yeah, think about the trucks. We bought them in 1952, and we didn't replace the Jeeps until, I think, 1976, 77. Yeah. The three-quarter tons about the same time. The two-and-a-half-ton trucks we didn't replace until, I think, in the early 80s. And the five-ton trucks, we replaced some in Germany. We bought some stuff off the Germans. But the Canadian five-ton truck replacement program, was the deal was signed to replace them, I think, about 1988.
Hmm.
So we're in 1988. We're still driving five-ton trucks made in 1952.
Wow.
And the M109s, of course, we bought them off the shelf from the Americans. In 68,
mm-hmm.
and we were still driving them, of course, until we came home from Germany. But a lot of people had them, so you could get them repaired. You could get them repaired and overhauled and get the spare parts through the American system or the German system.
Mm-hmm.
And the Leopard, of course, we buttoned down to, there was something called the Leopard User Nations Committee, which was called the Leopard Club, and all the Leopard User Nations were members of it, and we got together to buy spare parts and stuff in bulk from the manufacturers and save money.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans are very conscious of that. They ran the Leopard Club, of course.
Did they?
Their tank. Oh, yeah. It was always a German Oberst, colonel. A very stern guy. We must have by existing. How?
Did you learn to speak German?
No, just enough to recognize what I didn't want to eat on the menus.
Which was essential, I'm sure.
Yes, well, no Canadian was going to eat snails, you know, so you learned very early on that it was Schnecken. I actually got to the point where I liked them.
Really?
Oh, yeah, snails and frog's legs. Frog's legs in German are Frosch Schinken.
What's that?
Frosch is the word for frog, and Schinken is the word for ham. But I wound up eating them. But the one thing I refused to eat were eels, which is A-A-L in German.
Huh.
But, you know, you get up and drink enough wine one night, and somebody said, oh, you know, everybody's eating snails. They must be okay.
Yeah.
Hey, they're great. Put enough butter and garlic on them.
I guess so.
And the frog's legs I had in France, and they were delicious.
Yeah. I've heard that frog's legs are quite a bit like chicken. But
yeah.
Should we digress a little bit? Now, where were your supplies coming from? I think you said they were coming, some were coming from Britain, some from Germany, and then others from Canada.
Depending on where we were. Up north, we were buttoned onto the British supply chain. And the medical chain, we got our medical stuff from them, and it was quite simple because we were attached to the British Army, and so we had Canadians all the way back through their supply system to kind of keep an eye on our stuff coming forward. When we moved south, I don't think anybody paid a lot of attention to how we'd get stuff. And when I got there in 76, we'd been down south for, 74, we'd been down south for 4 years and a bit, and they still hadn't got all the wrinkles out of the system. And partly because Germans said, you know, if we were attached permanently to the Germany, they'd be happy to give us everything. The Americans the same, but since we were sort of in in the crack in the between the two of them, they were not really terribly interested. Yeah. So we got a lot of stuff, I think, through the American system. And Al Ricketts can probably help you on that one. But and Ron Myers might be able to, because he used to come over on staff visits the odd time because he was in the supply side back in Canada. And I said nobody knew the system better than him. But it was, and we'd been on the American system up north when we bought the M113s and the M109s. So there were, you know, there were some things that were fairly straightforward, but other things were not.
Yeah.
And we had to have a pure Canadian supply system for the pure Canadian stuff.
Now, it's true, when we bought the Leopards, they first went to Canada, did not we kind of Canadianized them?
Well, we got loan Leopards for the first 2 years, and then we decided that we would buy a German Leopard, but we wanted the Belgian Sabka fire control system in the Leopard. And so we had a unique tank. The Belgians had the same sort of tank, but they were way up north. And so ours were the Canadian Leopards. And we would get them rebuilt in Germany if they needed a repair and overhaul. The Germans would do it for us. The Germans had a big tank detachment in Camp Shiloh, Manitoba.
Really?
And we would rebuild their Leopards in 202 Base Workshop in Montreal, where we would rebuild our own Canadian Leopards. Yeah. And we did a very good job. They were very pleased with it. So, and they had a lot more tanks than we did in Shiloh than we had in Germany. So we had a deal, you know, we'll rebuild two of your tanks in Canada. You'll rebuild two of ours in Germany. Eventually we got to the point where they owed us. Because they were, we had so many fewer tanks that they were rebuilding. And when they went to the Leopard 2s in Canada, we did a study to see if we could rebuild them for them, and we could. And they gave us one, and, but then we never bought Leopard 2s, and they eventually went home from Shiloh. So, but now if we get Leopard 2s, we know we can rebuild them because we looked at it.
Yeah, exactly. That's really interesting. Okay, moving on to talk about Canada's role in the NATO Brigade. As a man on the ground, what role were you made to feel that Canada was playing in the defense in Europe?
Up north, we were basically in the front lines. When the balloon went up, we knew exactly where we were supposed to go, and it was a chunk of the lines that held by the British. The British had their own zone, the Belgians, the Dutch, and the Germans all had their own chunks of North Germany to protect, and we were part of the British order of battle in North Germany, and a very key part of the defensive battle. So we had a piece of real estate with a, with our brigade up north, which was about 6,000 strong, which would probably almost be the equivalent of what a British division would hold, which would be a two-brigade or three-brigade division.
So as one brigade, you
as
have,
one brigade, When we moved down south, of course, the brigade was cut in two. It was only about 3,000 strong. Instead of something like 60 Centurion tanks, we had maybe 30-odd Leopards. And we lost a couple of batteries of guns. We lost a whole battalion of infantry. And the infantry battalions went from about 1,000 people down to about 600. So we were sort of, we might have gone with the Americans and we might have gone with the Germans. And that decision would be probably made when the war started, which is kind of awkward.
Yeah.
We knew where we were supposed to go. And it was sort of in the gap between 2nd German Corps and 2nd 7th U.S. Corps. But there was a lot more question marks, in my view anyway, up down south, than there would be up north. But I, you know, I knew where I was supposed to go. I knew where the brigade was supposed to go in my time there. And it was a fairly interesting piece of real estate, but it was perhaps not as far forward. We were going to go to a kind of a holding area. And then the decision would be made, oh, you're with the Americans, and, and you're going to go there. Oh, are you with the Germans, you're going to go there. So we were in a sort of a holding area between the two and a little way back.
So the deployment zones were not at all as
not
clear?
Not as clear cut.
No, no, okay. So, and then you would just go to the holding zone and then and wait there until you got your orders.
That was my understanding. It may be a little rusty now because it's been a while.
Now, did you feel that Canada's presence in Germany was essential to the defense and stability of Europe?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Both in real terms, especially up north. I mean, we were a big piece of the action. British Army of the Rhine were three divisions and us. And there was a Belgian corps up there. And There was, of course, all kinds of Germans. There was a Dutch division. We were probably almost the equivalent of a British division. Mm-hmm. And so it was important for the defense of Germany, and, of course, our capability, because we were an all-professional army, you know, no draftees and stuff like that, whereas almost everybody else except the Brits had a draftee army. Down south, the Americans still had a draftee army when I got there. They had just done away with the draft. The last draftees were about to go home, I think, about the time I came home. But the Germans and the Belgians and the French and everybody else were still a draftee army. So we were considered very capable mm-hmm. in terms of professional. And I think the NATO allies thought that we were important to have, pardon me, a Canadian presence on the ground because it was a North American presence like the American presence. So while we were there, Canada was going to be involved in the defense of Western Europe, and we had basically going to pay for it in blood. Up north, there was a proposal. I don't think they'd ever actually exercise it. A second brigade would come over if the balloon mm-hmm. was going up, and it was three brigades in Gagetown. One of the reasons it was put in Gagetown was close to the Port of St. John. And there was equipment for another brigade.
Was there really?
Mostly in Germany, yeah. There was a fair bit of stuff over there.
Up north.
Down south, there was an exercise called, the Americans had one called Reforger, the Reinforcement of Germany. They'd fly a whole extra division in. Mm-hmm. And we'd sometimes bring in an extra bunch of tankers and maybe an extra infantry company, some of them militia. But I don't think we were ever as committed mm-hmm. down south as we were up north, partly because Mr. Trudeau, of course, was not in favor of mm-hmm. any of that stuff. And it was difficult to do, and it was expensive.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was the question, how do we get our civilians out? We were there with our wives and kids.
Yeah.
The original brigade that went up north, they were there for a year with no families.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess after about 2 years, it was not very good on the morale of either the soldiers or the families. And so they decided that they would do like the British did and garrison mm-hmm. Germany with the wives and kids. And the question always was, if the balloon went up, where did they go?
Yeah.
There were plans for it, but that depended on a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Wives and kids in the car the other way, was it not?
Yeah. And the theory was, in some cases, if we flew over the manpower for our second brigade up north, the airplanes that flew back could take the wives and kids.
Right.
That was a theory, anyway. Of course, our Air Force had they could transport lots of people. They couldn't transport lots of equipment. Well, they had mostly passenger aircraft. Mm-hmm. And there was something like 14 Yukons, which were passenger-type aircraft. They could fly 120 or 130 people at a time over and take the same number back.
Yeah.
But and down south, I guess they had the same sort of plans eventually, but they didn't even put them out when they moved south. The move south was done so quickly that a lot of things just didn't get done. And the in-depth planning that was done up north and had been practiced for years with exercises with the Brits just didn't get done mm-hmm. down south for a while.
Mm-hmm. Now, what were Canada's specific responsibilities in the event of a conflict? Now, you said this is kind of touching on the last question, where it was more fuzzy down south.
Yeah, there's both up north and down south, they had a GDP, what they call a GDP, which is the General Deployment Plan, which was where you would go, you know, where all the American troops and the British troops and everybody else would go, and the Canadians had their own GDP area. Up north, of course, was, I think it was on the Weser.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me I recce'd it back in 68, 69. Down south, I'm not sure where it was going to be, because it'd be up to either the Germans or the Americans to put us in the line mm-hmm. after we were cut to one of the mm-hmm. two, after we went to our GDP reserve area, which was sort of between the two corps, somewhere around Nuremberg, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there ever a point at which Corps CMBG came close to reacting to a Soviet action?
There was a lot of nervousness in 1968 at the time mm-hmm. of the Prague Spring. Mm-hmm. And it was a big surprise. At least I'm told that there were a couple of Canadian intelligence officers at a higher level headquarters that said something funny is going to happen in Czechoslovakia. Mm-hmm. And nobody believed them. And suddenly the Soviets went in.
Yeah.
And at the time there was a lot of nervousness, but it sort of died down. But I think at the higher levels, there was a considerable mm-hmm. Twitchiness about with this. You know, if mm-hmm. these guys saw that they could get into Prague mm-hmm. that easily, mm-hmm. when they decided that they could mm-hmm. maybe get into Frankfurt and places like that that easily.
And you were in Zost at that time?
I was.
Yeah. Okay. Did you notice any sort of change in the atmosphere or in the general tenseness of the of the brigade at that time?
If memory serves rightly, I think we were about ready to go on our fall exercises.
Okay, so yeah.
I'm just trying to remember exactly when it happened. We were just organizing the service battalion in the fall of 68, mm-hmm. and, you know, cobbling together something like 10 little units into one big one. And so it was kind of a hairy time. And
yeah.
I know we went out to the Saltau concentration and practiced things, mm-hmm. and then we went on a great big British divisional exercise and practiced that. And I went home in the spring out of the summer of 69, and the brigade went out in the autumn of 69 under General Gardner. Mm-hmm. And I think Gene Lake might have been there at the time and attacked a British division as if we were a Soviet mm-hmm. force and went right through them, just like
the Canadians did.
Yeah, just like shit through a goose. The guy that ran the recce squadron at the time was a guy named Jack Dangerfield, a young major mm-hmm. who's now living in Kelowna, retired as a three-star
okay,
general.
Okay.
And I think Gene was working with him. Mm-hmm. Gene Lake. Maybe wrong. You know, Gene might have been the G, what they used to call the Staff Captain A in the Brigade Headquarters, the senior personnel guy. I think
yeah.
he was.
Yeah, yeah, I think yeah, he was, yeah.
Yeah, he was. So he'd know all about that.
Yeah, okay. Now, what sort of ideological background were you provided with in terms of Soviet communism, if any?
Don't recall any.
No, okay.
We knew a fair bit about Soviet mm-hmm. or bat, you know, the order of battle and how they would, yeah. in theory, how they would fight. But I don't recall ever discussing the mm-hmm. politics of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Certainly not in the military sphere. Mm-hmm. And in my day, we used to have to do promotion exams, lieutenant to captain and then captain to major. And one of the exams in the captain to major package, and there were 3-hour exams, was in current affairs.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was anything hot in this mm-hmm. Soviet stuff, that could be a topic you'd study. And we used to buy Maclean's magazine and Time and things like
yeah.
that, and read up and study up for the whole year and then write the exam. And I did a course, a political science course, back in, the late 1950s. Canadian, what was it called? I think it was Democratic Government
yeah.
and Politics. And the textbook was by Dr. Corey, who was the principal of Queen's University. So you
mm-hmm.
looked at democracy, fascism, and communism, but from a theoretical viewpoint, mm-hmm. not how it worked in the Soviet mm-hmm. Union. So I don't remember any courses at my level until I did the Army Staff course, which is 69-70
yeah.
after I came home from Germany. We got a little bit about the Soviet Union, but that was, you know, background mm-hmm. to how are these guys
mm-hmm.
going to fight.
Mm-hmm. So there was no effort on part of the military to direct the way you thought about...
Not in my branch,
yeah.
anyway.
Yeah, okay. It was more tactical.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. To what extent did you feel appreciated and valued by the local German population?
Oh, they were always glad to see us.
Yeah?
Yeah.
As Canadians,
yeah,
specifically?
Yeah, up north and down south. Of course, a lot of Canadian soldiers in the Zost area married German girls.
Mm.
We had a number of Canadians that were of German ancestry who spoke the language. Every unit had a bunch of them. And we also had soldiers who were married German girls who would be back in Germany on their second or third
mm-hmm.
tours who had mastered enough of the language because the wives would speak to the kids in the home. That they could get by in German. And of course we spent money. You know,
mm-hmm.
we went on exercise. If you didn't like what was in the can of rations, you'd go to a gas stop.
Yeah.
Ate a lot of schnitzel.
Yeah.
And I love German food.
Yeah?
Oh yeah, there's a German restaurant a block from my house.
Is there?
My wife hates it, so she's going out with a girl. I'm into the sauerkraut.
Well, we should go sometime.
Jawohl.
Now, what can you tell me about the percentage of a unit strength that was allowed to be on leave at any given time?
There was a number, and it was restricted, and it was very carefully controlled, and I can't remember what the number
okay.
was.
I've heard it referred to as a 70% rule.
Could be.
Meaning only 30% was ever allowed to be gone, but I'm not sure for what duration that extends over.
Yeah, and when you had a big exercise coming up,
yeah.
like Senelager, Saltau, a big divisional exercise, a core exercise down south, leave was restricted,
mm-hmm.
so everybody had to be on deck.
Mm-hmm.
It was very difficult. There was a policy, certainly up north, that you didn't go home on a career course,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the reasons they wanted anybody that came to Germany to have all the courses that he or she required before they ever got
okay.
there. And if you were, say, a mechanic, that meant what we used to call trade qualification 5, which is journeyman level
mm-hmm.
mechanic. And it was very, very restricted to what courses. If you're going back, say, for a 1-year course, you'd be posted home.
Would you?
With your family,
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
Yep. So I went to the Army Staff course in 69. That was a posting home from
mm-hmm.
Germany.
So that that contributed to the professionalism in the Canadian Army, too.
Oh, yeah, at least in Germany.
Yeah.
And, of course, the guys at home would whine, oh, well, you just get a guy trained and he goes to Germany. And until you went to Germany, yeah. And it was great.
Now, both Trudeau's Defense Review of 69 and National Defense Minister Eric Nielsen's Review of 85 called for priorities closer to home in the limitation of Canada's NATO commitment to West Germany. And both reviews were met with anger on the part of various NATO capitals. So the Canadian government eventually backtracked to main positive relations, with the case of Trudeau decreasing the brigade in half, basically. But my question to you is this. Why do you think that other NATO members, particularly Britain and Germany, were set on retaining the Canadian force on the ground in Europe?
Partly because we were seen as a good military contribution. Partly because the politics of having us on the ground was useful. They thought if the Canadians go home, then maybe the Americans will start to thin out.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was always an attitude behind the scenes, never expressed to us at the time, but to the people in NATO headquarters, certainly, that Canada was trying to do it on the cheap, i.e. they wanted the glory.
Really?
They wanted the glory, but they didn't want to put their money where their mouth was, especially after we went down south.
Yeah. Do you think that sentiment was there even when you were up north, when we first...
I never heard it up north, yeah. But, you know, the Brits valued us for what we were doing, but we were always saying, you know, we could do more if we had more. The soldiers were always saying this, and, of course, the Brits and the Germans and the Americans would pick this up and say, yeah, you know, we are really thin on... Everybody was thin on the ground, considering the strength of the Soviet forces in Germany.
Yeah.
And there was a wonderful cartoon. I don't know if you ever saw it. It showed this poor little mouse and this huge eagle sweeping down on him. And the mouse had his hand behind his back with his fingers crossed, and he was giving the eagle the finger. And written across the eagle, it was USSR. And the mouse was labeled NATO. And it was the last gesture of defiance.
How fitting a visual image that is, hey?
I think we probably would have held our own, but they just had so much bench strength.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think anybody realized quite how, well, we weren't sure that the Hungarians and the Czechs and the Poles would be very enthusiastic.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be pushed across the border by the Soviets, and the Soviets would be in the second echelon, you know.
Yeah.
So these guys were cannon fodder, and the fresh Soviet troops would roll over. So I think that was the thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But I know we were valued, certainly by the British, and certainly by the NATO higher-ups in the military chain of command anyway.
For the people, is that classic dichotomy between the politicians
and the
military generals. And
you think that most of the members of Parliament, or a great number of them, in the 60s and even in the 70s, were World War II veterans, even guys like Hellyer, who I think wasn't as an idiot, but Trudeau had never served in the military, at least not overseas, and some of the key players hadn't. Eric Nielsen, of course, had. He was a bomber pilot, and these guys are all gone now, and there's nobody in Parliament that's getting war experience, but there are three or four MPs that are ex-military, O'Connor being one of them, and they all tend to be on the Conservative benches.
Yeah. Now, at what point did the man on the ground realize that the Cold War was no longer potentially hot, sort of, and that the Soviet aggression was dying down?
Certainly that wasn't the case when I was there.
No.
And I went from 4 Brigade in 76. I went back to teach at the Army Staff College in Kingston. So I visited the brigade twice a year with the Staff College. And so I was there right up to 1979.
Yeah.
And we were still very much twitchy about the Soviets.
Yeah.
And I had a funny job in 81, 82 that got me over to NATO headquarters twice, in autumn of 81 and the spring of 82. And it was still very much a big question mark then, as to, you know, how dangerous are these guys?
Yeah.
And because this was in the pre-Gorbachev era, you know, how serious are they? And the word we were getting from the intelligence guys was that there's no diminution in the size of the group of Soviet forces in Germany. They're still there. And if things ever got push came to shove, I guess the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan showed us that they were still capable of moving into another country. And so right up until I got out, I guess when the wall came down, that was probably the first indication that things were going to change. But I don't think the Cold War really ended until Gorbachev disappeared and Yeltsin took over in, what, 91?
Yeah.
So that's...
That came almost as much of a surprise to them as it did to us.
Yeah. I told a lot of guys that the Soviet Union collapsed when I retired because they figured they weren't a threat anymore. You know,
I like your sense of humor. Speaking about perception a little bit of the Soviet threat, was any sort of information provided to you in terms of Soviet history to the military? You said current events.
Yep.
What about the background of the Soviet sort of the generation of communism in the Soviet Union?
No. I read a fair bit about it.
You did.
But, yeah. And I took two correspondence courses when I was there. But the first one was called Military Studies 1, and it was basically an overview of military history. And the second one was Military Studies 2, which was, for lack of a better word, geopolitics. Mm-hmm. And one of the books we had to read as a textbook was called Makers of Modern Strategy, mm-hmm. the original version by Edward Miero, and there was some stuff in there on Soviet warfighting doctrine and how it fit in with the Soviet mm-hmm. concept mm-hmm. of communism. But that was about it.
Okay. And not a lot of that was personally instigated as well. You were interested, so you read some.
Yeah, and a lot of guys were.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
When I got to Germany in 65, Scherer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich had just come out.
Yeah,
everybody was reading that.
Yeah.
I mean, here we were in Germany, you know, what was this really all about? Because we knew some of the war stuff, but we didn't know the background of the Nazi Party and how they'd gotten involved and what a horrible man this was. And I mean, we used to train in Bergen-Hona, and the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp was just down the road. So we all used to go down there, and there were all the graves. Anne Frank had died in Bergen-Belsen. So that was kind of humbling.
Okay.
But most of the death camps were behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah.
And we were not allowed to go there.
Yeah. Now, from the time you began with 4CMBG until the time you left, just comment on the most significant changes you witnessed in terms of weapon supply, in terms of government funding and support, in terms of troop numbers. Basically, what stands out to you about your time there?
Okay. We, up north, we thought we were probably under strength, but we were much better looked after up north, and we were much more combat effective because we were much bigger than we were after we moved down south. I think that governments up until 1970 realized that we were a valuable diplomatic resource, and certainly they were told that we were a valuable military resource. When we moved down south, we were probably less important diplomatically because, you know, we didn't have complete support from the Germans or the Americans because they didn't know if they were going to own us. And certainly we didn't have the backup and the supply system because it was much more difficult to arrange down south. So in terms of combat effectiveness, pound for pound, I think the soldiers were just about as good as they were up north.
Mm-hmm.
But there were so many less of us. And the stuff was getting a whole lot older, too.
Yeah.
You know, the trucks were now, Lord, well, at 76, they were 24 years old.
Yeah.
And so were the tanks.
Yeah. So you definitely noticed, corresponding with the Trudeau government, though, that sort of decline, that whole move to the south, the decrease in government support, decrease in government emphasis upon the brigade group there?
Yeah. I didn't realize just how bad it was until long afterwards when I got out. And in fact, several books on Canadian defense policy by a guy named Douglas Bland.
Hmm.
He's at Queen's University. Douglas S. Bland, and he's done a very good series of books. One of them is examining Canadian defense policy, and the book will actually have each of the white papers of defense, starting with Brooke Laxton's defense statement back at the time we got into NATO, and then the white paper that Hellyer did, and the white paper that was done in 71, and the Perrin-Beatty white paper with comments by Doug Bland. We were lieutenants in Germany.
Oh, no way, okay.
And then my second tour in Germany, he was a major around the recce squadron
in the
RCD, then eventually got himself a PhD and wrote the book on Canadian defense. Mm-hmm. The administration of Canadian defense policy was his PhD thesis, and he's now done some books on evolution of our diplomatic side of our defense policy, so check him in the library.
Good, I will for sure, that's great. Can you comment on any trends you noticed in terms of government support for Canada's NATO contingent in West Germany? It's like kind of the same thing.
Talked a great game.
Yeah.
The question is, did they put their money where their mouth is?
Yeah.
You think up north, for example, trucks, the transport company that brought the supplies up to the brigade, what we call combat supplies, which is ammunition, rations, and petrol, oil, and lubricants. Up north, we had 80 trucks with at least two drivers per truck, so you could run them all the time. Down south, we had 40 trucks with one driver per truck. So if a guy got sick, that truck didn't move.
Literally sliced in half.
Yeah. And up north, not only did we have 80 trucks, but there were backup trucks available both in the brigade and behind us. And down south, the backup trucks weren't there at all. Nobody else had the same trucks we did, as old as ours were. So that's just an example on the supply side, you know. On the combat arms side, of course, we went from a tank regiment with 80 Centurion family vehicles, most of which had guns on them, to instead of three big squadrons of 20 tanks each, we went to two little squadrons and had very little backup.
Now, do you think that this decrease was mostly in terms of budgetary constraint? Why was the government...
Well, I think the message was send them, cut them in half and send them. So the decision was cut them in half, from 6,000 down to 3,000, and then see what they can do with what they got left. And so there was, you know, right away, you try and make fewer guys do more jobs. And so if it's going to be having two guys per truck and one less guy in a tank, then it's going to be one guy per truck, so that extra guy is now in the tank, which makes real sense for day one of the war, but day four, when nobody drives the trucks with the supplies enough, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And of course, everything else falls out, you know, when you start clamping down. It's like when you go on a diet. You eat the important things, and you leave the unimportant things aside.
Yeah.
So what you consider unimportant, and what you consider unimportant is who's making the decision.
Mm-hmm.
The government will say one thing, and the military will say another.
And what do you think the government's motivation was?
More money on social spending.
Yeah.
And, of course, deficit financing and everything else that was happening in the Trudeau era.
Yeah.
I mean, they balanced the budget right up until 1972. And then the budget started running a deficit. And when the Conservatives got in 79, John Crosby was the finance minister, took a look at it and said, Lord, we better do something about this. Brought down a budget that was going to start addressing the deficit and eventually the debt. And they got defeated.
Mm-hmm.
So the Liberals got back in, and Mr. Trudeau, I'm sure, said, hey, nobody cares about the deficit. And, of course, by five years later, it was twice what it was.
Yeah.
And the Conservatives were trying to do something about it, but just the paying the interest on the debt was, as I can remember, in 82, or I think I had to refinance my house. Was it 82 or 83? And the interest rates were something like 18% on the mortgage.
Monumental.
Oh, yeah. Terrible.
Oh, my goodness.
However.
Now, can you comment on any changes in the perception of the Soviet threat over the years? Was it always... And I've asked... Every time I ask somebody this question, they tend to say, beginning to the end, it was just tense. What do you think?
Yeah, of course, when you're over there, you're getting all the briefings of what's going on and what these guys are doing. And we used to have a British military mission to Soviet Army. Dave Waters served that in Berlin.
Yeah.
Britain.
Yeah.
And they used to be poking around our areas all the time. Soxmas, we called them, up north, the Soviet military mission to British Army of the Rhine. Down south, they were called Snowums, Soviet military liaison mission. And they were always poking around the brigade area. Mm-hmm. You go on exercise, and there they'd be. And they weren't supposed to be there, so you have to report them, and everybody would shake their fingers. And so we didn't know. And, of course, if anybody was thinking that things were relaxing, the Prague Spring kind of put... Invasion of Czechoslovakia kind of put an end to that in mid-1968, that these guys were still out there and they were still dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in the Reagan era, the early days of the Reagan era, when they started talking about putting tactical nuclear missiles in Germany, I wasn't there at the time, but that certainly heightened the tensions on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a certain amount of saber-rattling by the Russians and counter-saber-rattling by the Americans. And... And by and large, I think that kept the tensions very high.
Yeah. Now, if you wouldn't mind just giving me a little bit of a detailing on your role, your duties specifically in the north when you're up north until 69 and then when you're down until the 70s.
My role?
Yeah, your job. Exactly what you did.
When I was up north, I went in 1965 as a lieutenant, and I was a platoon commander.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a platoon that fixed the wheel trucks. About 45 guys. Then in 66, I moved over to run what they called the Forward Repair Platoon, which was about 45 guys, and they would go out and repair tanks and armored personnel carriers where they broke down.
Okay, so they would be right on the field and exercise?
Yeah, we were always out in the field, but if a truck broke down, it would be brought back to the workshop where we had the equipment to fix it undercover. If a tank broke down, of course, or an M113A1, A, it was a lot harder to move because it was tracked, and B, because you couldn't tow it back, and B, you wanted to fix it as soon as possible, close to where it broke down, because the crew would stay with it. So my second platoon went out and repaired the things where they broke down, the forward repair platoon. Then I took over as the administrative officer of the workshop as a captain, and I was the guy that pushed all the paperwork for a while. And then my last year in the workshop, I was still a captain. I became the charge of the recovery platoon and also the training officer. So I was the guy that did all the training plans. But my platoon in the field were the guys that had the recovery vehicles that would go and take the broken down equipment and bring it back, the stuff that could be brought back. Then in 68, they created the service battalion.
Yeah.
And I was posted into the battalion headquarters as one of the, what they call, logistic operations officers. I was a staff officer in the headquarters, you know, writing up standing operating procedures. And in the field, one of the guys in the command post that sent stuff out from the battalion, somebody phoned in wanting supplies or transports or something. So the battalion headquarters organized all that, and that's what I did.
Okay.
My second tour in Germany, I was the commanding officer of the service battalion. So I just sat around and watched the guys work. It was easy.
It wasn't easy. Now, Dave Walters was a commanding officer.
Yes,
well,
he was.
Yeah.
Good one, too.
Yeah. I'm sure you both were. Okay, so that brings things to a close. Can I just get your oral consent on tape? It's okay for us to use what we've taken in this interview today and use it for research in the UVic.
Oh, yeah, my full permission to use any of this stuff.
Wonderful.
On tape or on paper or whatever else.
Good, thank you so much.
My pleasure.